You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Jarrett Adams spent nearly a decade in prison here in Wisconsin after a wrongful conviction for sexual assault. After getting his conviction overturned, his record expunged, he became an attorney himself, working with others who are wrongfully behind bars and with people who have long sentences for minor offenses. He shares his story in his new book, a firsthand account of some of the injustices in our criminal justice and prison systems and how he's trying to make them right. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or someone you know spent time in the criminal justice system? How did it impact life after getting out? What barriers to reentry did you encounter? Do you have questions for our guest about his experience and the justice system here in Wisconsin, which has the worst racial disparity for imprisonment in the entire country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jarrett Adams is an attorney and the author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate being back on.
Well, you've shared your story with us in the past. I want to focus in on a particular moment here. You write in your introduction, quoting, "In this country, we have two criminal justice systems, the one you can afford and the one you can't." Can you talk about how that system let you down? It worked differently for you and one of your then friends who was charged was able to afford an attorney. Can you talk about that double system?
Yeah, it's a double system for sure. I mean, and you don't have to just take my words for it. You can look at the numbers and they glaringly show it. In my case in particular, there were three of us accused of the sexual assault. Only one of my friends was able to afford an attorney. Me and my other co-defendant, you know, we were assigned an attorney off of a panel list. And that directly impacted my case so much so that the retained attorney for my friend was filing motion after motion after motion. My attorney and my other co-defendant's panelist attorney as well never joined in this motion. They never gave us the opportunity to. They made the decision to proceed forward to trial. And it was the fork in the road that took almost a decade of both of our lives.
And that's one of the most frustrating parts of your story to read, the interactions you had with lawyers during your trial. Can you talk about how that system let you down? And you write, it's not just that it's the lawyers themselves. Those public defenders are often overwhelmed with many cases.
They definitely are. And in particular, in my case, we didn't get public defenders. You know, the public defender's office was conflicted out. So we were assigned attorneys off of a panel list in the state of Wisconsin and in other states as well. There's a panel list of attorneys who are assigned cases by the court. And the problem with that is this. First of all, the amount of pay is so low that you don't get the best representation. Not many attorneys are going to go do cases for $50 an hour or $70 an hour. And so that was, you know, a big issue in my case as well. And then, you know, it's one of these things, Rob, where you're on an island and you are facing the might of the entire system. They're not playing when they say state versus whoever it is. And it was just glaring. No investigator was hired in my case. And I thought it was just me. When I got to prison and when I started to meet other men and helping them with their cases and learn about their cases, I saw this across the board.
You spent time almost 10 years in Wisconsin's prison system, and you write that for people there wrongly or who are guilty, you don't see the prison system doing a lot of good to turn them around. What were some of the biggest flaws, the problems you saw in Wisconsin prisons?
You know, it's just, first of all, there's overcrowding. It's way too many people who are in prison, and they are in prison as a result of these old draconian sentences and in the ways in which we feel like lock them up, throw away the key forever. And so, you know, you're in this prison, and these mandatory sentences, they are the seed for hopelessness. If people know that they're going to be in prison, no matter how good they are, no matter how much they change and how much they reform, if they know they're going to be in prison for two decades, there's no incentive for them to do anything positive at all. So that was one of the biggest things. Another thing is this, Rob, there's no correcting at all going on. You're being warehoused in this prison. And you're pretty much just getting up, going to sleep, getting up, going to sleep. There has to be an investment in the people that are there. inmates are people as well. And you just don't see the educational, tools being handed out. Most people who are incarcerated will go home at some point. And we are doing a horrible job of preparing people to reintegrate back into society.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Jarrett, something I hadn't known until I read your book. You ended up in Boscobel, once called the Supermax Prison in Wisconsin, billed as being this site for the worst of the worst in the prison system. How did you end up there?
So you know that old saying in baseball, if you build it, they will come? That's exactly what Boscobel was. There was this rush to build this sparkling brand new facility for the worst of the worst. And it was one of these things where they took the Jeffrey Dahmer murder and they used that to scare people into getting the funding to build this prison. And when they built it, there was no worst of the worst like that. There was only a handful of people who you could say even, deserved and met the criteria to be there. So what they did was this. They started to, like almost like a quota ticket system, they started to create allegations of confidential informants and putting people in segregation for 360 days at a time. And they swept me up in one of those. And they did this in large part because I continued to litigate against the Department of Corrections, their handbook, and some of the things that we weren't getting access to education-wise in there. So it's just, it was one of these things where you had this message going out that it was necessary, that it was needed. But then you saw people going there for, they broke off the front of their razor to get a close shave, or, this person had food in his cell. And it just was ridiculous. And I don't think anyone really looked under the hood until, they had so many people packed and the litigation finally opened up Boscobel to a normal prison that it is now.
Okay, Jarrett, you spend almost, again, 10 years. You've been working on your case the whole time. The Innocence Project helps out. Finally, you get the conviction overturned. Your record was expunged. If you had said, I'm going to stay as far away from prisons and the legal system as I possibly can, I would get it. You went the opposite direction. What made you decide to become a lawyer and work to prevent this from happening to other people?
There are certain things that I will never forget, being in prison for so long. And one of the things isn't an act of violence. It was looking at the creases of pain and anguish on my mother's face. I'll never forget seeing that. And I also acknowledge this. Look, this started because I told my parents I was going to spend the night over a friend's house. My friends told their parents they were spending the night over my house. So we snuck to Wisconsin to go to this party. And it just was the worst fears realized. I now know why my mother was creative and keeping me busy in the summer. And, all type of things that African-American parents have to do to keep their kids out of trouble. And so when I came home, I knew I had a penchant for the law, and it became a passion, and I was driven to remove the wrinkles and creases of anguish off of other mothers' faces as well.
You had vowed you wouldn't come back to Wisconsin unless you did it as an attorney. Can you share this moment, you share it in the book, at the state capitol, I think it was, when you were sworn into the Wisconsin bar?
I was sworn into the Wisconsin bar by Keith Finley. So it was
of the Innocence Project.
Yeah, of the Innocence Project. And so it was really, really a dream type moment, to hear him, swear me in, motion that I get in and I be accepted and acknowledged by all of the justices. And I'll make this point too, Rob. If the justices, if the courts could see me as I am now, when I was a 17-year-old, I never would have been sentenced to 28 years in prison. And so I think it's a point that I want to emphasize on, and I enjoyed the moment and it inspired me to keep going to create other Jarrett Adams.
We're talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney, author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced the criminal justice system on either side as someone accused of a crime, somebody defending that person, somebody prosecuting it? Have you seen somebody in your family go through this experience? Have you yourself? What could we do better, do you think, here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for our guest. It's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Jarrett Adams about his new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Now an attorney, he was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in jail, or in prison, I should say, before the conviction was overturned, his record expunged. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Alicia is with us in Portage. Alicia, hi. Alicia, are you there? Nope. Let's go to Vivian then in Green Bay. Vivian, hello.
Hello. I am a product of a very rural Wisconsin community. I'm in my 70s and watching exposés, going back to the New York Five, to so many things through the Innocence Project, I think justice system is a misnomer, and when anyone refers to it that way, I say we don't have a justice system, we have a judicial system, and I've never had any encounters in that system, but I don't see it as a justice system.
Vivian, thanks a lot for the call. Jarrett, what do you think of Vivian's distinction?
I agree. And it's, you know, it's encouraging, you know, to have, you know, someone in Green Bay in their 70s who's been around a while and seen a lot in life, you know, to acknowledge that. And now we just need the officials, the lawmakers to acknowledge it as well. We have a system that pounds people, especially people of color. One in every 36 Black Wisconsin adults is incarcerated in a state prison in Wisconsin. I mean, that number should make everyone drop what they're doing and turn their attention to fixing this system.
Thanks for that call, Vivian, at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Pierre in La Crosse. Pierre, hi.
Yeah, I am calling because the justice system, there is a white justice system and there is a Black justice system. What you can't even say called justice system, because I have a family member that was charged with a crime. They charged with the highest crime in order for them to just try to negotiate it to a lower crime where they should have charged them that at, in the first place. And in the same person, they were charged high with a felony. And I know another person that did almost the same crime. They got charged with two different felony, but that person with the two different felony end up having no probation, nothing to do because they were white. And that other family member end up having to be on probation for a year and paying a whole bunch of fines that he cannot even afford.
Pierre, thanks for the call. Is this a common story, you think, Jarrett? Two different systems, Pierre says, depending on race.
Absolutely. I mean, and I think people should, you know, just look at the numbers, you know, look at the recent article that came out, you know, in Wisconsin, 42% of the state prison population in 2019 was African-Americans. I mean, just think about that. Think about the number of residents in the population in Milwaukee, which is the biggest jurisdiction where the African-American population is. I mean, if you think about the men that we have incarcerated and you think about the issues that exist within the inner cities, you're taking away a proponent that could fix, that can change, that can mentor. We're literally throwing away people with this truth in sentencing. And it was ran on the basis of, let's do truth in sentencing. Let's, you know, have all of these sentences where we give this time and they have to complete it because it'll make us safer. Rob, it's not safer. It's not.
Pierre, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. And Pierre's call reminds me, Jarrett, he talked about, you know, being charged with one thing and settling for a lesser offense, something you learned from your personal experience. And then again, as an attorney, is a lot of times people, especially maybe a young person in that situation, it's complicated. Courts are complicated things. They may not be getting good advice when they're making that kind of decision on the spot.
Absolutely. And there's also this, Rob. Look, people make decisions sometimes to get out of the pain that they're in. And I met a number of different men who pled guilty just to get out of the Milwaukee House of Corrections, only to come back and go to prison because they were on parole. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we have to inject in our system is this. We have to get more therapists, social workers, forensic psychologists. We need to allow the world of therapy to mend this system. I mean, I'm talking about both ends, right? I'm talking about both correctional officers. I've seen and have befriended some correctional officers who come in to these jobs and within, you know, a year or even months, I mean, it's almost like they're an inmate as well. They're feeling the effects of this system, which is telling us something. The system isn't working.
Talking to Jarrett Adams, attorney. He was wrongfully convicted, spent almost 10 years in Wisconsin prisons. His new book is called Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. Jarrett, wrongfully convicted. You're in prison for so long, 360 days in segregation, as we mentioned, at Bosco Bell. What got you through?
You know, I had a round table of angels and my mother and my two aunts. And I opened the book up, Redeeming Justice. The first page is a dedication to them. And what they would do is they would write letters in a staggered approach. One would write a letter on Monday, the other on Wednesday, the other on Friday. And they would write these letters and they would, you know, have Bible verses inside of them. And, you know, I asked my aunt, you know, because she would give me like the newspaper subscription. I would get it late. And I asked her, I said, why do you, you know, send this paper still and you guys write these letters? I hear from you guys enough. I'll talk. And she says, no, listen, there's a reason why we're doing it. And the reason why we're doing it is this. We've acknowledged that they've confined your body, that you can never let them incarcerate your mind. And that was one of the things that kept me getting through. You know, when I came home and I was on a race pace to get this law degree. And I remember my boss at the time, I was working at the Federal Defender, you know, she was just like, you know, look, you got to take a break. Like, what are you, you know, moving so fast for? And the real reality, Rob, was this, that decade wasn't just stolen from me. It was stolen from my family as well. I was cookouts, fish fries before I went to prison. I come home, there's dialysis treatments, there are visits in old folks' home. So I was racing because I wanted my aunts to see me get this law degree. And I was fortunate enough to get that done before my aunt Josephine passed away.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tina is with us in Shawano. Tina, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I've been a practicing attorney in Wisconsin for almost 34 years now. And I've been a prosecutor a couple times. I've been a defense attorney. I've been a social services attorney. I've been a judge on a few occasions. And, you know, my observation is that our system is not only broken, it's completely corrupt. You know, not only do we treat, you know, people of color, you know, differently, substantially differently, you know, it's really all about money. The courts have to, it's like any other bureaucracy, the courts have to make money. And they charge fines that no one can pay. No one can pay those, even if they have, you know, a decent job, which in Shawano is like $14 an hour. You know, they don't take an effect, you know, how this process affects families. You know, they drag out cases, they overcharge, they over-sentence. I mean, it's completely corrupt. It doesn't work at all. And if we want a system that works, we have to provide more of it. You know, for lack of a better word, in the Native American community, would call it a healing program.
Tina, thanks a lot for sharing your perspective. And Jarrett, that reminds me, part of your work now is on wrongful convictions. You're also worried about what Tina mentioned there, overcharging people for lesser crimes, either longer prison systems, sentences, or as Tina mentioned, unpayable fines.
Absolutely. I mean, Tina was spot on with that. We over-punish and pummel the poor. In our society, I want people to understand there are people in living in the inner city, you know, in Milwaukee, where every dollar and penny is accounted for month to month. And so, you know, a speeding ticket, a red light camera ticket or something like that can throw them off of their entire budget. You know, I also want to point out this, you know, I'm representing a guy right now, Antoine Robbins. You know, he was convicted of an armed robbery along with his co-defendant who was Caucasian. his co-defendant, you know, received a significantly less sentence and has been home now for quite some time after only serving about 7 years. Mr. Robinson has been in prison now for the last 20 years on an armed robbery where no one was killed and no one was shot. It makes absolutely no sense why we can't even get a court to you know, consider really using the law of sentence modifications. It's just, we have to overhaul the system, and that overall has to be more than just changing the faucet. We need to rip up the floor and change the pipes.
Jared, just in our last minute, do you see that happening anytime soon, that kind of reform, that kind of overhaul?
Well, it's anything like this on this grand scale is going to take a lot of folks, a lot of time and a lot of resources. And this has to be spearheaded by the law schools as well as the judicial system and the lawyers and prosecutors. Everyone has to have an all hands on deck approach. And I'll use this as an example. We just dealt with the pandemic where for a while, people stopped fighting with each other because we were fighting this deadly virus. And, you know, what we did was come together and figure it out. And then we went back to fighting each other. But the point I'm making is, if we all came together and decided to make change, real change, systematic change, where we got diverse people on the bench and in a prosecutor's office, we would have a much better system and we would have much better communities than we have right now.
Jared, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You guys have me back anytime.
That's Jared Adams, attorney and author of the new book, Redeeming Justice, From Defendant to Defender, My Fight for Equity on Both Sides of a Broken System. You can listen back to this conversation and anything you missed here on Central Time by looking through our archives. Those are on the WPR smartphone app and at WPR.org. While you're there, find coverage from WPR News, our latest podcasts, and stream the Ideas Network live. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. And then we'll learn how we humans can actually work with the emotion of anxiety. In fact, we're wired that way. A neuroscientist explains all about good anxiety and offers strategies for figuring out what makes us anxious and how to have a positive response to it. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. If you experience anxiety, you are far from alone. In fact, our next guest says anxiety is a common human experience, even though we don't always recognize it for what it is. And while it may affect people differently, there is some good news. We can learn to re-channel anxiety and use it as a force for good in our lives. In her new book, our guest shares a lot of strategies to help us understand our anxiety, find out what triggers it, and to help retrain our brains to live better with it. Wendy Suzuki is a professor of neuroscience and psychology in the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. She's an authority on neuroplasticity and mental health. Her new book is called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Wendy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I wanted to ask you first about the scope of anxiety in the United States when we include people with, you know, clinically diagnosable anxiety and people who have maybe not that level, but where anxiety is affecting their lives. How common is this?
Very, very common. Even before the pandemic started, 90% of Americans raised their hands and said that they experience anxiety very, very commonly. And that has only gone up. So basically, all of us have anxiety. But as you point out, there's a wide spectrum of anxiety, from clinical anxiety, which is a different beast that needs medical attention, just like a broken leg would. My book focuses on the lower levels of severity of anxiety, what I call everyday anxiety, but that covers a huge swath of the American population these days.
It's kind of a twist here. I think a lot of people have to, and I had to, stop and think about this, the idea that anxiety isn't in and of itself a bad thing, that there are things we can do, and we'll talk about what those things are, to use anxiety for a force for good in our lives. Can you make the case that it's worth taking the time to recalculate our thoughts about anxiety?
Absolutely. The reason why everybody needs to recalculate their views on anxiety is because high levels of chronic anxiety lead to high levels of chronic stress hormone, cortisol, in your system, We know that it's very bad for your physiological system. It can affect your heart, your digestive system, even your long-term reproductive systems are affected. And also my specialty, the brain. Long-term high levels of stress hormones, cortisol, can first damage the input structures to brain cells called neurons. And then eventually with really high levels that continue for a long time can actually kill brain cells in two key brain areas, the hippocampus, critical for memory, and the prefrontal cortex, critical for decision-making. Those are areas that you want to preserve for as long as you can. So this is why everybody should learn how to harness their anxiety to do good things in their lives.
I want to dig into one key concept that's going to let us help do that. Brain plasticity or neuroplasticity. What do we mean by that?
Brain plasticity is the brain's amazing ability to respond to the external environment. It can respond in a positive way by learning new things, taking advantage of creativity to solve problems and to respond in a positive way to things like physical activity, meditation, good sleep that you provide the brain. Brain plasticity can also go in the negative direction. And the best example there is high levels of chronic stress can damage the brain for the long term. So we have the capacity to change our brains and make it stronger and better. And one of the things that we can do is decrease stress turning down the volume on our anxiety. And that can lead to a more creative and productive life.
We're talking to Wendy Suzuki about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about anxiety, what it is, how we know what it is, what it does to our brains? Have you come up with strategies in your life that let you deal with long-term or short-term anxiety yourself? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Wendy, your book is full of concrete suggestions for figuring out our anxiety, what it is, what it does to us, and then how to deal with it. Let's start with the first step, recognizing anxiety. I've dealt with anxiety for years. Only in the last couple of years did I know what to call it. How do we start to see how it is affecting our lives?
Yeah, that's a great point. So my simple definition of anxiety is that feeling of fear or worry that often accompanies uncertain situations. So that is kind of a clear definition of our life today with the coronavirus pandemic. It introduces so much uncertainty, and that has really increased our level of anxiety. But do you have that fear or your worry, whether you acknowledge it or you do like I've learned that I do all the time, which is kind of mask it and just ignore it. Mm-hmm. That is anxiety, and you want to put it in check. Make sure you understand it and are kind of using it to your best advantage, because it is a human emotion. It was evolved to protect us, even though it's not protecting us right now because its volume is too high. And that's why we really want to start to pay attention to it in a new way.
I want to talk about that idea of anxiety as something that evolved as a positive tool. Did I just see a tiger in the bushes over there or a snake or whatever? Anxiety can be a pretty good thing that gives me the energy and impetus I need to do something about it, right?
Absolutely. Even more than a good, pretty good thing, it is essential for our survival. We evolved the emotion of anxiety to kind of put us on edge and get us into action if we needed action. If we relied on our own decision-making skills, you know, sometimes maybe you do want to run away from the lion, sometimes you don't feel like it, and bam, you know, you're gone. So that, you know, you can imagine if you were somebody living 2.5 million years ago, it is essential. But jump to our present day, and we have things that provoke our anxiety that don't come along every once in a while. It's several times an hour. With the weather report can produce anxiety. The news feed, the social media feed, all are inducing anxiety. And these are all the things that are turning the volume up on our anxiety. And you know, too much of anything, even a good thing, is bad. And that is why our current kind of societal level of high levels of anxiety has lost its protective element. And so the first step in my book is learning how to turn it down.
Let's talk about figuring out maybe the unhealthy responses to anxiety we have. You've got some quizzes in your book, and I love that you do this in a very non-judgmental way, by the way, of saying, what negative behaviors does my anxiety drive me to that feel good in the short run, maybe, but over time, they're bad.
Yes.
How do we start to spot those?
Well, you know, just start to list them. Also, I try to be not non-judgmental. You try and be non-judgmental on yourself. So I'll just use some of my own examples of anxiety coping strategies. They always involved sugar. So brownies, ice cream, a nice cold beer at the end of the day. Every once in a while, those things are great. But if I turn to those things every single time I feel anxious, that could lead quickly to rapid weight gain and not feeling so good overall. So what are some of those things in your life? Just to start, awareness is so key in this book. Awareness of your own anxiety, awareness that anxiety at its core is good. That is a really important, but it takes some time to wrap your head around that. But all of these awarenesses will lead to towards what I call good anxiety.
We're talking to Wendy Suzuki, professor of neuroscience and psychology in the Center for Neuroscience at New York University. We're talking about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. We'll pick up the conversation, get more strategies on dealing with our anxiety coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about anxiety and how we can actually use it for good and grow from it. Our guest is Wendy Suzuki, a neuroscientist from New York University. We're talking about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. You could join in if you'd like at 800-642-1234. Was there a time in your life where you felt like anxiety was getting the better of you day to day? How did you come out of it? If you came out of it, do you have advice maybe to share with others or a question about how anxiety works? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Wendy, we just talked about spotting the things that our anxiety triggers us to do. Let's take the next step now. When we're in that rut, when we've carved out that neural pathway that says anxiety equals the sugary treat or the drink or the road rage or whatever it might be, how do we start crafting that new path in a better direction?
Yeah, that's a great question. And the first step that I would take is to focus on the anxiety itself rather than the response to the anxiety. So I spent a lot of time coming up with a wide range of really doable tools to decrease the volume on our anxiety. And the very first tool that I give to everybody everywhere is breath, deep breath work. And did you know that breathing deeply is literally activating a part of your nervous system that is designed to de-stress you? Everybody's heard of the fight or flight response that comes with anxiety, that feeling of nervousness that is getting you ready to either fight the lion or run away. Did you know that there is an equal and opposite part of the nervous system that was designed to bring you back to normal states after stress? And this is what you are activating when you breathe deeply. This system does slow down your breathing. So this is something you can do consciously. It has an immediate effect on your feeling of anxiety. You can do it with your kids. You can do it in the middle of a conversation that is causing you anxiety. So it's a very powerful tool.
Another common theme in your book, Wendy, is kind of our self-talk, I guess, how we think in our brains about the problem that's causing or problems that are causing us stress and anxiety. How do we reframe those from negative, bad, self-judgmental ways of talking to more positive ways that are going to help help decrease that anxiety?
Yeah. I think I talk about something that's called the negativity bias in my book. So the negativity bias is something all humans have. When given an array of good and bad things, particularly about yourself, What do? You focus on that one comment that that one person said that, you know, said that your talk was terrible when everybody else said it was great. And you focus on that. And it comes out in other ways, in meetings. One has to be very careful about the negative comments that one makes about a candidate or something being evaluated, because that has a lot more weight than a positive thing that you might say. We are just biased towards that. It is partially a protective mechanism, but it's partially recognizing that in ourselves. I actually was just called out for doing that to myself the other day by friends. And I thought, oh my God, I'm doing it to myself. One of the things that I found really helpful is I've had the opportunity to work with coaches career coaches, and they are so great at stepping back and really seeing both the best aspects of you and also the parts that need work, but couching it in a positive light. Can you learn to be your best coach? And even if you haven't had a coach, everybody has a friend that has that positive outlook. And so you can use that friend as a model to turn in on yourself and ask yourself, am I being that negative bias self, or am I being the good coach self? And that is a wonderful thing to practice.
Talking to Wendy Suzuki about her new book, Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. You could join in with your questions, maybe your experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wendy, it's interesting to me that people aren't calling in, and I think that may mean something. Are we too reluctant in some cases? I understand people might not want to do it on a radio show, but are we too reluctant to talk about something that's going on in our minds, like anxiety? Is that part of our problem?
Absolutely. In fact, with all the people I've talked to since the publication of this book, I've noticed that there's a lot of shame around the emotion of anxiety. And part of the book, and part of the reason I wrote the book, was an invitation to start the conversation. Why? Because 90% of Americans identified as anxious even before the pandemic. So basically, every single person in the room right now is feeling this feeling of anxiety. There's nothing to be shameful about. Everybody has this emotion. It is part of the human emotional spectrum. And so, while I totally understand that it takes a little while to wrap your head around that, there still is a lot of shame around anxiety. And so, you know, I shared all of my anxieties. You'll read all about them in my book. They're very common ones. And I was an anxiety denier, I learned while writing this book. I like to kind of hide the anxiety from the outside world. But I got over that because now I've written about it and everybody can learn about all of my anxieties in this book.
I think sometimes people might think of anxiety as being irrational, maybe. But I could think of a lot of rational reasons for people to be anxious about stuff. Am I going to get the job? Am I going to find a life partner? Hey, there's this pandemic. I'm worried about that. How do we deal with very reasonable anxieties in our lives so that they don't overwhelm us from minute to minute?
Well, I think that's a great question. And I would say that one of the tools that I think is so powerful in this book is the tool of mindset. How are you thinking about this? So instead of worrying about a job, your promotion, that is critical. And beating yourself up and saying, what's the matter with me? I can't get over this. Think about that emotion, that worry and that fear that might come with worrying about your job as a little sign or a big sign saying, this is something important. Pay attention to me. And that starts to make sense. That is useful. That is protective. Now, again, you can't do much if you're, in depths of anxiety. So that is why I gave so many tools to turn that volume down. But it's never going to go away. And that is the signal that I hear is a signal telling me, this is something that is important, or this is something that has worried me or scared me since I was a young child. And so I talk about my social anxiety that I had. I've gotten over it because I'm a professor, so I can speak no problem, but I still have anxiety in social situations. And that came from years of, of suffering from social anxiety as a shy, awkward kid.
Let's go to our callers now. George is with us in Ashland. George, hi.
Good afternoon. I was listening to your conversation as I'm mowing the lawn here in Ashland, and it struck me that if a person identifies or identity is tied up with the thoughts going around in their heads, they're going to suffer more anxiety than if they just realize that their brain is going to spit out a lot of stuff that is not them, that they don't have to identify with. May make a difference for them.
Interesting, George. So we don't have to identify ourselves. We are not our anxiety, he's saying, I think, Wendy.
I love that. I think that's a great way to think about it. A wonderful mindset shift, that those thoughts of worry are not me. That is something that I do because I'm a human, and I'm a human that has the emotion of anxiety. Great mindset tool.
George, thanks for that call. Nicole joins us now in Eau Claire. Nicole, hi.
Hi. This is a question for you about middle school, upper elementary students and some techniques for getting them to flip their self-talk or their mindset when they're sort of maybe above the idea of I'm going to breathe because people have been just telling me to breathe since I've been five, you know, or, you know, looking in the mirror and giving yourself that sort of like pep talk with, you know, without actually making them think you just want to see them smile and say nice things.
Interesting. Nicole, great question and a great time to develop good self-talk habits, I imagine, Wendy.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are so many different ways to do it. There are looking in the mirror, as you say. There are mantras that you can do. One of my favorite forms of exercise that I actually teach is a form of exercise called Intensati, that every single movement that you do is associated with a positive spoken affirmation. So there's jumping jacks and you say, I believe I will succeed during the jumping jacks or front punches that are associated with the saying, I am strong now. So there's a lot of fun ways to get your kids to kind of enact these take in these positive comments about themselves. And I bring this up because I've done this with kids. I've done this with adults. I've taught it for 7 years for free at NYU. And there's nothing like, you know, shouting out these positive things with a whole bunch of other sweaty affirmation shouting people. You feel a little silly at first, but you feel really good. And I've had parents and their kids send me videos of them doing the same affirmations that I put on Vimeo. And they say that they do it every morning together. So that might be an idea for you.
Thanks for the call, Nicole. I want to take our last half a minute or so, Wendy. One of my favorite bits of advice from your book is being creative as a tool to decrease anxiety. Leave us with a plug for that, please.
Yeah. So creativity is really part of the tools that you'll use to shift your mindset. There are literally hundreds of ways to approach the same situation. But sometimes that anxiety-provoking situation that's always provoked anxiety, you feel like there's only one way, there's only one outcome. So the book encourages you to use your creative mind to come up with five different ways to change that, to approach it in a different way, to end it in a different way, to make the middle different. And in doing that, you start to see the power of mindset shift and you start to kind of practice that positive brain plasticity, that learning of your creative muscle, brain muscle, that will help you address your anxiety situations in a new way. And you're bound to find a way that will lower your anxiety levels.
Wendy, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Wendy Suzuki from New York University. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Good Anxiety, Harnessing the Power of the Most Misunderstood Emotion. Coming up after the news, we want to hear your best recipe for potatoes or maybe your biggest potato cooking question. It's a special potato edition of Food Friday. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.